Reading this morning before the lesson is 1 Samuel 23, 14 through 18. David stayed in the desert strongholds and in the hills of the desert of Ziph. Day after day, Saul searched for him, but God did not give David into his hands. While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this." The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained at Horesh.
It's really great to be back. We've missed everybody, and I know only half of us are back, but we are really glad to be back. We got to get a few things done. We had a good break, and we're excited to get back and get to work. A couple things before I get right into the lesson. You might have noticed the communion bread was a little different. I didn't want anybody to worry about that, because my understanding would be it's made out of things, probably grains more like they would have had around Bible times. They had flax and barley, things like that. And what I wanted to use this as a teaching moment. What we see in Scripture is the bread had to be unleavened bread. We don't see what kind of bread it had to be. We don't know what kind of flour they used, and the implication then is whatever kind of flour somebody brought and made it out of, that's what they made it out of. And so that's a good thing for us to learn. Something similar today might be, we've never thought before, I wonder what kind of flour they grabbed off of the shelf and made this from. But I thought if you saw the color and you said, well, that's a little different, I didn't want you to worry about it. In fact, it's sort of neat to think about the idea that we very well used a grain more like what Jesus would use whenever he instituted the Lord's Supper at the Passover. What we do know is the bread that he had wouldn't have been fluffy, risen bread like we think of as bread. It'd have been unleavened bread. And so that's where we get our authority in Scripture to try to be like that first century church. And so I want to be like they were. And so what were they doing? They were using bread that was unleavened every first day of the week, like we see in Acts chapter 20, verse 7. So I just wanted to bring that up. We've got some visitors with us. It's fantastic to have you, and I'm sure you've been warmly welcomed. And if you have any questions about anything while you're here, don't hesitate to ask me or someone that you came with or know here, and I'm sure you'll be met with a cordial, kind answer, and of course we strive for it to be a biblical one. So we'd be happy to talk to you about that. We are together today, and we are going to talk about something that unfortunately there's debate about, just about with anything, and that is, what's a friend? And there are different ways we can define friends. I believe we're pretty clear on what friends are not. And we talk about someone who's just around when you're healthy and happy. Maybe they're only around when you've got a little bit of money. And we say, well, they're a fair weather friend, if you can call them a friend at all, right? Or there's this other kind of friend that seems like society more and more is calling a friend, and that's a person who just, they love you for you, which sounds good, but they will support you in anything that you do. And we call that a friend. Is that really a friend like we want to see? And as I look at 1 Samuel, I see Jonathan and David, and they really seem like they had a great friendship. Not great in the sense that you look at their lives and you say, didn't have a lot of fun. You look at their friendship and say, wasn't it so happy? In fact, it was a very tragic friendship, wasn't it? But you look at their friendship, and it had characteristics of it that we could do well to emulate today. In Proverbs chapter 18, verse 24, we see for a man to have friends, he must himself be friendly. So we want to say, well, I want to have friends, and not just any kind of friend, but good friends. And one of the best ways to do that is to myself be a good friend. I want to do that. I hope you want to do that. And so we can learn from Scripture how to do that. And something that's important to realize is that as much as we try to act like it's not the case, there's a difference in friends. And what do I mean by that? You look at worldly wisdom, excuse me, you look at worldly wisdom, and worldly wisdom indicates that you can only have so many close friends. When you look at Scripture, you see that Jesus, while he had many disciples, and he had 12 apostles while he was on this earth, he had three who tended to come with him in Matthew chapter 17, Matthew chapter 26, Peter, James, and John, to special places. And only John in John chapter 20, verse 21, sorry, flip that, 21 verse 20, is called the one who Jesus loved. So why does John have that distinction? Evidently, while Jesus so loved the world, God so loved the world, he gave his only son, right? Evidently, John was a special kind of friend of Jesus. And Peter, James, and John, they spent time with Jesus in a different way. And so when I'm talking about being a good friend, I want us to understand it as encompassing really facets of all these different kinds of relationships. We don't need to feel bad about having those people with whom we're closest, and we need to be sure we're good friends to them. But at the same time, we don't exclude other people the best we can. But we're going to see that there's a balance, and there are limitations and restrictions there. But first of all, as we look at it, and we're going to look at what's going on here in 1 Samuel with Jonathan and David, we see that a good friend rejoices in good times with their friend. You go back to 1 Samuel chapter 18. And in 1 Samuel 18, we find that David has reason to celebrate, far more reason than many people might have known, because as kings are anointed, there's a process. Kings didn't just become kings overnight, but they were chosen to be kings. There was a process for them coming to step into their kingdom, and then they received their kingdom. And for David, it wasn't even that simple. But David's been anointed. He's defeated Goliath. And in chapter 18, it says, "Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, David, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." I'm not sure what all that incorporated, but David and Jonathan, both being humans, like us, if you've ever talked to somebody and you say, "We just click," maybe there was something like that. Maybe they just happened to get along. But more than that, I do know, they had a similar goal, as we're going to come to find. And whenever we have similar goals with people, it tends to help us in a relationship with them, because we find ourselves going the same way with them more often. And as we continue to read, it says, "Saul took him that day and would not let him," David, "go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant." They made a promise. "Because he loved him as his own soul." Whenever Jesus is asked what the chief command is, he says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength." And the second one is like it: "Love your neighbor as yourself." One way that you know you're treating someone correctly is if you love them like you love yourself. And not in a vain way, but you're going to take care of yourself, aren't you? You're not going to intentionally harm yourself. You're going to make decisions that are for your own good. Well, if you love someone else like you love yourself, that adjusts perhaps your attitude and how you might handle things with them. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, while it's not a chapter that's specifically meant to define love for us, because what it's doing is it's showing how much greater love is than any miracle, it does define love for us. And whenever we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, it would do well to remind us of what it means to love another. So as we're looking at Jonathan loving David as he loved himself, and we're seeing a good friend rejoices in good times with a friend, and we go back here to 1 Corinthians 13, and we'll read through all these and we'll refer back to them, because it's good for us to remember some of the characteristics that love has. And he says in verse 4, "Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." And if you said, "How do I like to treat myself?" And you look at the characteristics of love, you say, "I treat myself that way. I endure a lot of things for myself. I tend to believe the best in myself and say, I'm going to do better. I don't tend to assume the worst in myself. I certainly don't envy myself, because I am myself," right? There's some interesting things there when we look at it. But whenever we see good friends, here's David, he's just slain a giant. And there are these women who are going to say, Saul has slayed his thousands. Go King Saul. That'd make you happy until they finish the song. They say, but David, his 10,000s. And Saul eyed David from that day on. Saul was jealous of David. But Jonathan, on the other hand, practiced what we read about Romans chapter 12, verse 15. That is, we need to be able to rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Don't be like the brother I heard, who was in a congregation that I won't name, that the preacher, he saw the preacher driving a Cadillac. And he said, well, if a preacher can afford a Cadillac, he's going to pay too much. That was his response. And so he didn't, of course, go to the preacher. He just complained to some other people about it, that they were paying the preacher too much. And then he found out that because the preacher needed a car, there was a kind brother who gave him a Cadillac. And so how would my response be to that? I'd hope I could be happy for him because he had a Cadillac. Now, this brother, on the other hand, wasn't. He couldn't be happy for him because he was envious. Love does not envy. Love says, you know what, I might not have the nice things that you have, but I love you and I'm glad you have them. And I can be happy for you. Even though Jonathan was looking at a man, David, who is going to someday have his father's kingdom. Think about that for a moment. Jonathan was in line for that kingdom, and it was going to be taken away and given to David's house. Jonathan could rejoice in David and he could love him. We need to practice this. Whenever we're with someone and they're happy, instead of thinking of the things we don't have, love them as ourselves and say, I'm so glad for you. You know, I'd like that. I wish things were going better for me that way, but I can be happy for you that you have it. After all, it's something I would like to have. Do to others as you'd have them do to you. Right? We rejoice with those who rejoice, and we weep with those who weep. In Matthew chapter 17, we find that Jesus is going to share a very important event with some friends. And this brings up some interesting points about friendship when we're looking at it in this light. It says, now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, here's those three, and led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them, his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Now, as usual, Peter sort of goes above and beyond some. He steps a little too far, but what was he doing? He was, in a sense, celebrating with what was going on. He knew it was quite a fantastic thing. And look at what happens. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and suddenly a voice came out over the cloud saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him. And when the disciples heard it, they fell on their faces and were greatly afraid. But Jesus came and touched them and said, arise and do not be afraid. When they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. Now, as they came down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is risen from the dead. Now, Jesus told them not to tell somebody. Jesus could have ordered it this way. This is a secret. A good friend can rejoice. A good friend can keep a secret if it's a good thing. And why do I qualify that and say that if it's a good thing? You know, there are some secrets we shouldn't keep. How do we know? How can we tell the difference? Because we want to be a good friend, don't we? We want to be able to keep those secrets that we should. And then some things that shouldn't be secrets, we want to know how we ought to share them. And so, friend, we need to remember, thinking about how would I want to be treated? We rejoice in good times, but a good friend also remains in bad times. Again, you can be happy for someone when things are going well, but if when things go poorly, you leave, we call that a fair-weather friend, which I would argue isn't a friend at all. We don't want to be a friend like that. So what do we do? How do we do this, and where's the balance? In 1 Samuel 23, back where the scripture reading was, we find that Jonathan went to extreme measures to be a good friend to David. And why do I say that? Think about this for a moment. The enemy was in Jonathan's household. Saul, the father of Jonathan, was trying to find David to kill him. Not the first time either, but again and again and again he had tried this. And so Jonathan had every excuse to say, this is too hard for me. At least I'm going to stay out of it. But he was too good of a friend, and he loved David too much. And so what he did is he sought him out. David stayed in strongholds in the wilderness and remained in the mountains of the wilderness of Ziph. Saul sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. He has a friend who very well could have had a kingdom, a palace, wealth, and riches at this time, but he didn't. He was in caves, and he was hiding, and he was living off the land. And what did he do? He came and he visited him. Even though David didn't have anything to offer him, and even though it was a peril to him, he went out of his way and he visited. He did what he could. In verse 15 it says, so David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a forest. And this is where we find him when Jonathan goes to him. Jonathan stuck with him through, we would say, thick and thin, right? A good friend. In Matthew 26, we find these three again, Peter, James, and John, with Jesus. Jesus has them with him. And while they had their flaws, here they are in this difficult time with Jesus, and we see their limits to good friends. There are limits that we can't do anything about, and there are limits that we should do something about in bad times. And we're going to see a couple of these. In verse 36, this is after they've had the Passover, and Jesus has instituted the Lord's Supper. And it says, then Jesus came with them to the place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, sit here while I go and pray over there. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me. He went a little farther and fell on his face and prayed, saying, oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, what, could you not watch with me 1 hour? You see, do you think Peter, James, and John were trying to be there for Jesus? I don't have any reason not to think that they were. So what was the problem? In verse 41 says, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. I thought I'd bring this up because we have good friends, and there are times we really want to do something about it. We want to help them in times of trouble, but we can't. Is that okay? Peter, James, and John were with Jesus. They were falling asleep praying while he was praying to be delivered from what was happening in the garden. And what did Jesus have to say? The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. There's sometimes we just can't do something about it. And you know that's okay. In fact, that's why we can only have so many good friends. What do I mean? We can only have so many people that we can dedicate and devote the amount of time and energy it takes to build a very good friendship with someone, because we have limited time and resources and energy. Doesn't that make sense? Even Jesus on this earth had limits because he was in human form. And here we see these men had gone so far and they couldn't help past a certain point. What am I saying? Am I trying to give us an excuse not to be friendly? Not at all. Actually, I'm saying the contrary. Do we give what we can to our friends, the best we can, until we come to a point where we just can't? That's a good friend. Not being able to do something is not wrong. If you're not able to, you're not able to. We need to be careful we don't beat ourselves up about that. Because I've known good friends, perhaps you've done this, who hear of their friends suffering far away, and there's just no way they can get there to help. And sometimes they beat themselves up about it. You know, you can't do it. If you can't do it, it doesn't make you a bad friend. On the other hand, there are people who are able to drop things and go and be there. And that's something that a good friend then, if they can, they do. A good friend helps whenever they can, but there are limits physically, and then there are times that they shouldn't. Whenever we look at Proverbs 17:17, in talking about friends, the Proverbs writer says it this way, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born of adversity. A friend loves whenever things are going really well, sure, but at all times, even when they're not. And a brother is born of adversity. What does that mean? I thought brothers were born from same mothers, and that's how they're your brother, right? In But what it means is having gone through difficult times with someone can forge a brotherhood. In the end of Proverbs 18, it says there's a friend who is closer than a brother. And that would be that friend that's been born, not of a physical earthly mother, but been born of going through difficult things with you. Perhaps you can think of friends that you say, I love my family, I've got to, right? No, I love my family, but there's this person, and we've been through so much together, they're like a friend unlike any other person close to me. And isn't that interesting? That God's made us in such a way that we can be closer to people who we have no earthly relationship with than people that we do have a physical blood relationship with. And should it surprise us then that in the Lord's church, where we are, by the way, related by blood, Jesus' blood, we can develop a friendship unlike any other. And that seems to be what the idea of being friends is getting at in Scripture. Because whenever we're looking at people with the same goal, and whenever we're looking at people who have a united purpose, what greater goal than God, and what greater purpose than serving Christ? And we can certainly be true and good friends in that. Now, looking at this idea of friendship, though, when we remain in bad times, sometimes that's abused, and it's taken too far. And what do I mean? You might have heard this idea of parenting, where some parents have gone this way, and they are sort of their child's buddy. Anything that their kid wants to do, they're all for it. They're going to act like a child with their own kid. And the response to that is, I'm not my kid's friend, I'm their parent. Now, is that the only response? Is it either I'm their buddy and they can get away with anything and do anything, or I'm their parent and they don't get away with anything? Or maybe we have the wrong evaluation of what a friend is. Because should a friend be someone who should just allow you to get away with anything? Is that what a real friend is? And when we look at it, we find that in Scripture, it's not a good thing to allow somebody just to go wrong, just to behave poorly. And I like how it's brought up in Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6, again, is dealing with a very physical thing, the way Proverbs often does. But it's making a practical teaching because of the way things often work out. And it says, my son, if you become surety for your friend, if you have shaken hands in a pledge for a stranger, you are snared by the words of your mouth, you are taken by the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, and deliver yourself, for you have come into the hand of your friend. Go and humble yourself and plead with your friend. Now, what's going on here? Real quick, by the way, he's not saying never help your friend. That would be contradictory to the rest of Scripture. What's he saying? To become surety for someone, the close parallel we would have is, in a sense, to sign for a loan. Well, what happens when you sign for a loan for somebody? Legally, they don't have to pay that loan, and you're going to be held responsible for it. That's what's going to happen. And if you look by and large, again, the Proverbs teach general principles. The general principle is, if you take someone's responsibility away, it's likely they're not going to take it seriously. And that's what's happening here. He's saying, if you've gone into an agreement and you've taken the responsibility of a debt from your friend, you've put yourself in a bad way. And in fact, you're going to hurt your friendship. Because what's that going to do? That's going to put a divider between you and your friend, and it's also going to take any culpability, any sense of responsibility from your friend. Another word for it today would be enablement. You're being an enabler for a friend. A good friend does not enable, even though sometimes that might make them seem like a bad friend. A friend might say, I really want to engage in this activity. Maybe a friend wants to buy something they can't afford. Well, do they need a roof over their head? A good friend will make sure that their friend has a roof over their head. You can put them up in your house. You can help them with rent or something. But if you're signing for something that they can't afford, are you really being a good friend or enabling a bad lifestyle? Now, that's one way to put it. But whenever we look, perhaps, at drug addiction, that's another way that friends, that parents, can get it wrong if they're not careful. That is, you love the child and you want to take away consequences of their bad behavior. And in doing that, you end up enabling them because they don't feel the consequences so soon. And you think you're being a good friend or a good parent, and when what you're accidentally doing is you're helping them develop worse habits, hurting themselves worse. Not anything someone does intentionally, but something we've been taught under the guise of worldly friendship is, if you love me, you'll let me do whatever I want to do. You'll support me in it. Have you heard people talk like that? If you love me, you'll support me in whatever I want to do. Well, if you really love somebody, you're not going to support them in hurting themselves. And you'll have to draw a line. And so you're a good friend, and the good and the bad. And the way to help us balance this is a good friend reinforces godliness all of the time. A good friend is there in rejoicing in good times. A good friend is there in support in bad times, and all the time keeping this balance of, when am I supposed to be there? When am I supposed to let them be on their own? When am I supposed to support them? When am I supposed to stop them? The balance is, a good friend reinforces godliness all of the time. 1 Samuel 23, I love this phrase, and it's one thing that made this section jump out to me. It says, then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. Think of that. Of all the things Jonathan could have done, it says he strengthened his hand in God. I'm not sure what all that means. He goes on a little bit here and gives us some of it. But what am I saying of all the things Jonathan could have done? One, Jonathan could have just forsaken him. Two, Jonathan could have gone and done this. Jonathan could have gone and said, I know he's my dad, but he is so rotten, and he's betrayed you over and over and over again. You go and you take the kingdom. But one thing David was adamant about is he was not going to lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. That comes up over and over, doesn't it? He says, God chose Saul, and I'm not going to destroy Saul. And Jonathan here didn't encourage David to do something wicked. What he did, he didn't do nothing, and he didn't do something he shouldn't have done. What he did is he strengthened David's hand in God. And that's what we should work on doing to be good friends. We should say, what am I doing in my life around my friends, whether it's at school or at work or with my family? And is it something that's going to encourage them toward a path that God would want them to be on? Or am I going to discourage them from following God like they should? Because I certainly don't want to be in that latter part, do I? And he goes on, and he's going to do some things that I think are included under strengthening his hand. And he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. One, he proved his trust in God. Because that was quite a statement. I don't believe these were empty words, but think of what he was saying. He was saying, my father, the king, with an army and a nation at his command, he's not going to find you. That sounds pretty unrealistic, except for the fact that Jonathan trusted in God, and he had shown it over and over, just like David had. He says, you shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that. Next, he tells David what he should be. A good friend, and you all know this, you've seen it, maybe in a spouse, maybe in a friend, a good friend helps you be better than what you otherwise would be without them. Because they tell you what you need to be. A good friend is the one that after you've had lunch, they're going to say, you got something right there in your teeth, right? When other people would ignore it, a good friend tells you that. Why do they do that? Because a good friend is willing to take the heat to tell you something that you need to know that's going to make you better. That's a good friend. There are nice people, and I've done it too. There are nice people who look and they go, ooh, they have something on their teeth, but I don't want to say anything because I don't want to upset them, okay? But a good friend is going to tell you. Well, on a bigger, more important scale, a good friend is going to tell you what you should be, even if it hurts. And whenever we look, the Proverbs writer in Proverbs 27, verse 6, he covers this idea. And the way he words it is in talking about injuring somebody. He says, faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. And the contrast in this is so important, because if we're not careful, if we don't want to be the best that we can be, we're going to look for kisses from liars. And what do I mean? Sometimes it just feels nicer to have somebody lie to you and tell you you're good and you don't have anything to work on. But a real friend If they have to, they'll hurt you to tell you that you need to do something better, that you need to stop something. And that's what it's saying here. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. If you've ever been criticized about something you needed to be corrected on, you understand it hurts. It's not fun at all, is it? But it's helpful. And don't you love and respect that person more if you're thinking about it the right way, whenever they do correct you the way that they need to? So a good friend does things even if sometimes they hurt and are hard to do. When you go back to 2 Samuel 12, you see, go back to 2 Samuel 12 later on. Jonathan has died. He's not there to be what David needed. Maybe, this is Van speculating, I just wanted to throw this out there as a thought though. How would 2 Samuel 11 have gone if Jonathan were living? When David saw Bathsheba bathing on the roof, if David had somebody saying, "No, you're a king, you shouldn't be here doing this." Just maybe. But what about Nathan the prophet, who came in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and in verse 7, he says, "You're the man. You're the one guilty of taking what didn't belong to you and having someone murdered." David needed somebody to tell him that. It wasn't an easy thing to say, but Nathan said it. And of all times, who was being a friend to David? Nathan the prophet. And in verse 9, David repents. We all need a friend like that. We all need a friend like that because we all need to be a friend in Jesus. In John chapter 15, verse 14, Jesus said this. He says, "You are my friend if you do whatever I command you." Jesus had a way of just saying things just like they were. It shouldn't be surprising, right? Teaching so clearly that we can't miss that. There are many people who say they're friends to Jesus. There are many people who say they love him and that they know him. But in 1 John chapter 2, verse 3, it says, "By this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments." Someone can say they love Jesus and they know him and they're his friend, but if they don't follow him according to what his word teaches, then they aren't behaving as a friend of his. And if that's us, or if we have friends or family that are living contrary to the will of God, are we being a friend to them? What do I mean? Do I support them where I can, rejoice with them when I can? And then when I can't support them, do I make it clear, kindly and lovingly, that that's the case that I can't? And maybe you have a family member who's struggling with a lifestyle and sin. I say lifestyle, it seems like it softens, it doesn't. They're living in sin. One instance might be a family member who's living in adultery or homosexuality. And what are some things you can support them in? You can want them to be in good health. You can want them to be successful in life. You certainly want to support them in their spiritual lives, but you can't support them in their relationship. You can't support them in things that the world would consider accomplishments and what they're building in their home or their family, because that's contrary to what God's will is. So how do we do it doing that, being a good friend? We want to help teach our friend about Christ. We want to teach them that Jesus died according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried and rose the third day according to the Scriptures. Paul says that's the gospel of 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, how does someone obey the gospel? Because we know that there's a time when he's going to be visiting with his angels, and he's going to take vengeance on those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel. We learn about that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9. Now, if that's the case, then 2 Thessalonians, rather, then how do we obey the gospel? In Romans chapter 6, he asks the question, "How shall we who died to sin continue any longer in it? Or do you not know as many of you as were baptized into Christ were baptized into his death?" Have we died to our old man like we see pictured in Romans chapter 6? Because in verse 17, he talks about then looking back to that baptism, dying to our old man and resurrecting to walk in the newness of life. He says that that is a form of doctrine. That's the gospel that they had obeyed from their heart, that Jesus died, was buried, and resurrected the third day. If we have friends and family who haven't obeyed that, are we lovingly trying to work with them and teach them? If they hear from us, do they have a relationship with us that makes them say, "You know what, they've dealt with me with hard things before, and I know they love me, And they wouldn't bring this up if it wasn't essential, if it wasn't something that they had to. Maybe I should give it a look. If we can't talk to our friends about it, who can we talk to about it? But whatever your need is, if you haven't responded to the gospel, or you have and you need our prayers, we're here to support you today. Let your need be known by having a seat in one of these front pews as we stand and sing the invitation song.